The views expressed on this program are those of the host and the participants.
Okie dokie, welcome back to Media Matters Today. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, in WILL AM 580 here in beautiful Urbana, Illinois. We've got a live show, February 16th, 2003. Our guest today will be Norman Solomon. Norman Solomon is the Executive Director of the Institute for Public Accuracy, a nationwide consortium of public policy researchers. He's also the author of Media Beat, a nationally syndicated column on media and politics that appears in the San Francisco Examiner and other daily newspapers. He's a regular contributor to numerous publications and a longtime associate of the media watchdog group FAIR, Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting. Most recently, Norman Solomon is the author, along with journalist Reese Ehrlich, of the new book, Target Iraq, What the News Media Didn't Tell You. Norman Solomon has traveled to Iraq several times in recent months and organized two delegations, the first with Representative Nick Rahal of West Virginia and another with the actor Sean Penn. Norman Solomon is a friend of the show. He's been on before, and we're delighted to welcome him again. Norman, are you there?
Yes, I am. Hi, Bob.
Well, thank you so much for joining us. We've been wanting to get you on ever since you'd come back from your last trip to Iraq, and I guess the timing really couldn't be better to be talking about the possible forthcoming war, could it?
No, the blitz to the media is almost ever-present, and of course, yesterday, enormous protests in the United States and elsewhere in the world.
Yeah, why don't just a little news update for our listeners who haven't had a chance to really comb the media this morning or go online. Why don't you talk, if you would, maybe give our listeners an update of the events of the last week in terms of what the U.S. government has done and the international developments concerning Iraq, and then maybe the demonstrations yesterday.
Yeah, well, I think the report a couple of days ago by Hans Blix and Mr. El-Baradei, the two chief inspectors for the UN in Iraq, reports at the United Nations were really a bit of a disappointment for the Bush administration, even more so because the response from most of the members of the Security Council are not what the war doctors ordered or what they wanted. In Washington, they just felt, and I think feel even more, that they don't have a clear path to a second resolution. So that's been part of the picture. Meanwhile, just opposition has become even more apparent. In Britain yesterday, upwards of a million people protesting. I think England is stunned at this point. You know, there are, what, 50 or 60 million people in that country. And so to have a million-plus people marching against the policies of Tony Blair, I think is, you know, if we translated to this country, would be 5 million people marching in the same day proportionally. So I think the Labour Party is a bit in disarray because of the contradiction between a base which doesn't want war and Tony Blair, who clearly does. And by the way, Bob, I've been thinking about this charge that Tony Blair is a poodle to George W. Bush.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that may be a bit unfair. I think he's more of a border collie or a mastiff.
Okay.
But the ongoing challenge, I think, really is that you've got this split between people in France, Germany, Italy, England, and to a significant extent, the United States, many other countries that would be integral to a war. And on the other hand, you have many of those governments, certainly the United States and Britain and Italy, that are committed to going to war. And I think the way that the news media respond to that are quite interesting. For instance, the NPR newscast in the last few hours across the United States has been telling us that the Iraqi government has hailed yesterday's protests, rather than really telling us in the newscast much about those protests themselves or what people were saying from the rostrum. It's this kind of refracted propaganda, anti-propaganda, that by inference implies, I think, that the protests in the United States somehow have been aiding the Baghdad regime, which is clearly a distortion.
Now, the New York demonstration yesterday drew also, by conservative calculation, a good 200,000 people, and by less conservative calculation, significantly greater numbers. Now, these are, I mean, to put this in historical context, when was the last time we had demonstrations of this magnitude in the United States?
I think it was very fleetingly during the Gulf War, but probably even then did not reach this number.
I don't think the Gulf War came close to this, Norman.
Yeah, I think it reached six figures, but the low six figures, maybe 100, 150,000. This is more. You'd have to go back, I believe, to 1969 and 1970, the peak of what were called the Vietnam moratorium demonstrations. So we're talking a third of a century. And I must say, in the face of that kind of turnout in Washington and San Francisco a few weeks ago, this weekend in Manhattan, and then actually today in San Francisco, scheduled demonstrations, it's been a rather understated mass media response. And a lot of what we're getting is kind of elliptical, kind of indirect. I heard again on NPR this morning, on Morning Edition, Margot Adler and others reporting on demonstrations in a way that was really indirect about the fact that the permit was not allowed. This is something that we associate with repressive regimes. It historically happened in the South in Selma and elsewhere, where the local and state governments refused to give permits for orderly planned marches. And in San Francisco, there's not going to be a problem today. But in Manhattan yesterday, that was central to the dynamic. The mayor's office and the state of New York just refused to give permits for a march. And despite that, you had this enormous turnout, and you've had this kind of passive voice, a shrug of shoulders covered that says many thousands of people were not able to get to the rally site. Well, why? I mean, journalism is supposed to include not who, what, where, when, where, and also, but why? And that answer has not been forthcoming. People were not able in large numbers to get to the rally site because they were blockaded for dozens and dozens of blocks by police officers enforcing the lack of a permit being presented by the city of New York.
What other aspects of the demonstration yesterday and the demonstrations in general do you think good journalists should be writing about or good journalism should be discussing that really aren't getting much play in the news media today?
We need much more than just snippets about what people were saying. I mean, there were eloquent speeches that were provided. You wouldn't know it from CNN or Fox or MSNBC. You wouldn't know it from most of public radio coverage. But you had people at the rostrum who were speaking in basic terms about why this war is being opposed by so many people. There was a moral argument given that vast numbers of civilians would be slaughtered by a U.S.-UK attack. There was a strategic argument given that this would cause enormous upheaval and actually hurt the United States in many ways, including opening us up to more impetus for terrorism in our own country. There was a Middle East analysis given that the United States more and more has been aligning itself with repression, with human rights violations perpetrated by the Egyptian government, which have increased in number in terms of human rights abuses, the Saudi Arabian government, the Israeli occupation of the West Bank and Gaza, ongoing human rights violations, and just the upsetting the apple cart sort of dynamic where a lot of civil war could break out in Iraq and elsewhere, the slaughter of the Kurds that the Turks have been involved in, that's being winked at. Those sort of issues were really being addressed by speakers in New York, but you wouldn't know it from the media coverage in the last 24 hours.
We're talking to Norman Solomon today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. This is a live show, so we have our phone lines open. The topic today, the war in Iraq, the media coverage of the war, where we're going to go. Couldn't be more timely as the drumbeat for war beats loudly and incessantly in this country. The telephone number, if you'd like to call in, is 333-9455. Our toll-free number is 1-800-222-9455. Our guest again, Norman Solomon, who you've been listening to, I urge you to call in and take advantage of this hour. For one thing, Norman Solomon is one of the few American journalists who can say he has spent extensive time in Iraq within the past 4 or 5 months on the ground there to get a sense of what actually is taking place in that country. And Norman, why don't you give us a rundown? How many times have you been to Iraq? How long? And what exactly did you go looking for? And what did you find?
Well, I made three trips there. First, in September, I accompanied U.S. Congressperson Nick Rahal and former U.S. Senator Jim Abaresk, and also the head of the humanitarian aid group Conscience International. We spent a few days in Baghdad. We met with Iraqi officials. We went to the pediatric hospital, the Al Mansour Children's Hospital in Baghdad. And then I went back in December with the actor and director Sean Penn. We met with UNICEF officials. Those UNICEF officials took us around to schools in the Saddam City area of Baghdad. It's a Shiite ghetto, quite impoverished. And then in late January, I went with the former head of the UN Oil for Food Program, Dennis Halliday, who was Assistant Secretary General of the United Nations. And he quit his Oil for Food position in 1998 in protest of the functional role of sanctions, not the rhetorical one we hear about so much in the news media of helping to pressure the regime, but the lethal effects of the sanctions program led by the UN. And in all those visits, which each were a few days in Baghdad, I really tried to not only meet with officials, but talk to ordinary Iraqis. And the co-author of the book Target Iraq, Reese Ehrlich, spent a couple of weeks traveling around Iraq at times, able to visit with people without government minders, finding out about the effects of depleted uranium used in the first Gulf War by the U.S. and their allies, find out about the real effect of sanctions, and also to inquire both there and in the United States about the real oil factor. Why is the United States so hell-bent on war, and what is the relevance of the fact that there are about 112 billion barrels of oil still in Iraq, yet to be pumped? What are the motivations of the those who are bent on war in Washington?
And what I read here, and you hear often from U.S. government officials, is the Iraqi people being oppressed by the Saddam Hussein regime, which is, I think, universally regarded as a fairly despicable operation, actually would very much welcome an invasion that would overthrow this tyranny and permit them to pursue a more democratic course. I know it's probably difficult for you to gauge exactly an answer to that in the context you're in, but did you get any inkling that this was the case while you were in Iraq?
Well, Reese Ehrlich, in his original reporting, and both of us in talking to Western journalists informally in Iraq, are certainly of the conclusion that most people there, as despicable as they understandably find Saddam Hussein, do not want an invasion. People are reeling from a dozen years of sanctions and the devastation from the first Gulf War. Conservative estimates, perhaps 100,000 people killed in that six-week period. The sanctions' devastating effects, according to UNICEF, even halfway through the last decade, the first half dozen years after the war, upwards of 500,000 people dying, children dying as a result of the sanctions. This is a society in sustained shock. Their psychological and physical defenses are much eroded as human beings. So the prospect of another war is absolutely horrific, and I don't hesitate to say that most people dread and certainly are opposed to a U.S. attack, at the same time that it's clear the regime of Saddam Hussein is a murderous and repressive one.
We're talking to Norman Solomon today on Media Matters. We're going to go to the phone lines in a second. If you'd like to call in, we do have a couple of lines open. We're going to get all the callers on today because I think we're going to have a lot of them, but please do call 333-9455, the toll-free number 1-800-222-9455. Let's go to the phone lines now. Line 4, Eureka, you're on the air with Norman Solomon.
Thank you. First of all, Mr. Solomon, I'd like to thank you for your courage and your reporting. You are a breath of fresh air.
Well, thank you.
I have a question, and I hope it isn't too general. Apparently, from the outpouring of protests yesterday and the resistance in the United Nations, do you think these two strategies may be at least help postpone or stop an invasion by the United States?
Well, this kind of resistance is crucial. The protests in the streets from New York to Chicago to San Francisco today is really the reed, the thin reed, but the crucial one that is holding back the United States. And running parallel to that is the very complex political situation on the UN Security Council. I think that if there's any way to stop the war, it's because people, by literally the millions, are pouring out into the streets, and the rest of the time they're speaking, they're meeting, they're organizing, they're challenging, whether in their unions, their churches, their synagogues, their mosques, all sorts of civic life is really involved now with challenging the preparations for war. It's hard to be optimistic because the Blair and Bush governments are so hell-bent on launching this attack. But, you know, I think of what the anti-fascist Antonio Gramsci wrote under the reign of Mussolini. He talked about the necessity of pessimism of the intellect and optimism of the will, and we certainly have the imperative grounds for both. To be realistic, this is a very ugly, horrible situation, but also our will and determination could change history for the better.
Thank you again for your work.
Thank you.
So your will is optimistic, is that it? And your intellect pessimistic? I get those things confused sometimes. Then.
Yes. Well, I mean, I think that if we analyze things, intellectually and look at the empirical evidence, it is very much a long shot that an attack by the U.S. on Iraq can be prevented. I mean, the political stars are lined up not by chance but by calculation. The Rumsfelds and Cheneys and Bushes and Powells really want this war to happen despite the geopolitical obstacles that they're facing, including inside the U.S. But all through history, people have been able to do the almost impossible because they drew on their humanistic reserves, you might say, their internal personal and social resources to insist that they don't want to be a party to mass slaughter in this case.
Let's go back to the phone lines. Line one, Champagne, you're on the air with Norman Solomon.
Yes, thank you. Yes, unfortunately, I think I share your belief that it's going to be nearly impossible to stop this war from happening. But I think in the long run, it's going to backfire because in their ham-handed way to try to bully the rest of the world into doing, you know, the way that they want everybody to do and thinking that they're going to reorganize the, you know, politics in the Middle East and probably elsewhere, they're just going to end up getting everybody in the world turned against the United States.
Well, there's a certain irrationality, I think, to what's involved in terms of U.S. policy, and it's not being explored much by the media in our own country. I mean, the stock market clearly is responding negatively to the war drums, but then if you have so much oil involved, I think there is a calculus that, again, is not being deconstructed by our own media very much. It's a calculus that says, yeah, we're going to take our hits. The stock market may be even more shaky for quite a while because of this war, but there's a lot of oil there in Iraq, and there's also a geopolitical agenda here, U.S. domination of that region.
You know, Norman, Doug Henwood this morning, the economist who publishes Left Business Observer and writes for The Nation, had a piece on the war, and he argued that, you know, it shouldn't be underestimated that there are significant parts of the U.S. financial, political, military elite that are really not necessarily excited about this war. It's not a unified elite by any means, that there are branches of the policymaking elite in this country that see that there's tremendous risk and downside to this war, and then there are branches that see great benefits. What do you think of that analysis?
I think there's a lot to it. There is a split among the elites that's manifested in elite media, and so you can see, for instance, the New York Times editorial page, the official editorials of the newspaper, have been very skeptical in recent months, but they have been toning down that skepticism to the point that the editorials of the New York Times in recent weeks have been pretty pathetic. You know, the objections that they're raising are less and less fervent, more and more deferential to the policymakers in Washington. And I believe there is a dynamic here that assumes, in effect, this war is going to happen, the war train is leaving the station, we don't want to seem too marginalized by not being on that train, that bloody train, really, as it pulls out. And I think there's a parallel here with the news media zeal to try to marginalize those who dissent and analyze in a critical way these plans for war.
We're talking to Norman Solomon on Media Matters. The phone number 333-9455, the toll-free number 1-800-222-9455. We have a couple lines up, and we will get to all the callers. We had someone call and leave us already, but we will get to you if you call in. Line 3, Urbana, you're on the air with Norman Solomon.
Hi. You earlier mentioned that the media coverage has not been very good for the anti-war protests and all that. Is it only true for the U.S., and why is the media so uninterested in it? And how is the media coverage in other countries? Is it any better? I'll hang up and I'll listen to your answer.
Yeah.
That's a great question, isn't it?
It is. And there's a notable gap. The Atlantic Ocean has never seemed wider or deeper. For instance, if you were to read the Observer newspaper in London today, covering the demonstrations of that city yesterday, the tenor and tone of the coverage is much more critical, much more open to not just the surface of anti-war arguments and movements, but the substance of them. And I think the reasons why partly have to do with just the way in which corporate dominance of U.S. news media is so far along and the internalization of the outlook of the state, so that we have dynamics where it's not only who owns and who advertises on the media outlets, but also something that was pointed out to me when I wrote a column critiquing media language used in war and pre-war coverage. It was pointed out to me by a columnist for an East Coast newspaper, sent me an email and said, look, if we had an even-handed use of the word terrorism in our newspaper here, in our news articles, we would face potentially huge economic repercussions by the local power structure. The advertisers would go nuts. And I think that's something that we often downplay. We know that that's also something that happens with public broadcasting. The attempts by some outlets, NPR affiliates or NPR itself, to do less biased coverage, more even-handed coverage of the conflict between Israelis and Palestinians has resulted with the withdrawal of hundreds and hundreds of thousands of dollars from the NPR affiliate in Boston, precisely because the coverage was in some even small way departing from the standard U.S. media line, which echoes what's coming out of the White House.
We've got a lot of callers who want to get to you, Norma, but let me just follow up on this on one point before we get to the caller, so I ask to be patient. One of the reasons, obviously, or clearly, that coverage outside the United States tends to be somewhat more critical of the U.S. position and not take it at face value is that journalists in other countries aren't as reliant upon U.S. official sources as the basis of their news stories. But one of the things that's striking about the war coverage has been that you've had people like Senator Robert Byrd of Virginia, Senator Edward Kennedy of Massachusetts, I mean, leading political figures in this country, you know, among the top tier of U.S. senators in longevity and influence, issue really ringing denunciations of the government's policy in the most direct terms. Yet those voices don't seem to be getting very much play in our news media.
Yeah, I think the reliance on official sources generally is cutting to simply further reinforce the dominance from the Bush administration perspective. And we do have some voices. At the same time, Byrd and Kennedy are somewhat exceptional within the Democratic Party, say, in the House and Senate. And there's this negative synergy between what I would call the cowardice of most Democrats in Congress and the news media unwillingness to really step beyond what is seen to be the baseline of proper coverage. You know, there is that dynamic of reporters want to be ahead of the curve but not out on a limb. You know, they want to be ahead of the herd, but they don't want to be out of step. And that sets up this very much internalized process that says that we need to imitate our colleagues. And so it's a spiral that simply reinforces the dominant sort of media coverage.
We've got Norman Solomon on Media Matters today. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. Our phone lines are full. We're going to get to all the callers today. That's our promise. Let's go to line one. Pena, you're on the air with Norman Solomon.
Hello. I just like to add my voice to the fact that we just must keep trying for peace. If we're going to err, it must be on the side of charity. I think it was going to be a disastrous mistake if we try to go into Iraq with a unilateral attempt by just ourselves and Britain. And I think it's just going to be a terrible mistake. Thank you.
Well, thank you, caller.
Our book has a chapter called Unilateral by Any Other Name, and I think a lot of the setup that we have experienced was really being set up by the administration and the news media on the whole to say, oh, look, you know, we shouldn't go in by ourselves, but it would be legitimate if we go in with a coalition. It's called by the White House the Coalition of the Willing. I call it the Coalition for the Killing of vast numbers of civilians who are just as innocent of any wrongdoing as those who went to the World Trade Center on 9/11. We have a situation where the U.S. has the power to use carrots and sticks in the international arena, in the U.N. Security Council, to browbeat and bribe people in government positions and the governments themselves to go along to get along with the U.S. So they can whip into line Eastern European countries. They can get a bunch of so-called allies. We forget historically that during the Vietnam War, we were told it was an allied effort. You know, we had troops from New Zealand and Australia and South Korea. But a war by any other name, whether it's called multilateral or not, we have to analyze the rationales for the war and the human consequences. And I think on both counts, the U.S. news media have really failed to do any kind of balanced reporting on a regular basis.
Okay, let's go to line two, Urbana. You're on the air with Norman Solomon.
Yeah, thanks. I don't want to undercut your argument at all because I agree with it 100%. But today's Chicago Tribune, I want to try to elicit a response to something that was in an editorial in the Chicago Tribune today. Since you were in Iraq, it said, quote, Saddam's game of deny, deceive, and delay is still humming along. Unlike nations such as South Africa that have agreed to disarm, Iraq has led inspectors to not a single weapon, unquote. And I was wondering if, when you were there, did you deal with that issue, and what could you say about it? And I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
Oh, thanks. Well, I talked to reporters about it. I'm certainly not, you know, an arms inspector or an expert on arms inspections, but I think it's clear that Blix and Al-Baradei both feel that there's something very constructive going on with the inspections and want to continue. But this mantra in the news media about delay and deceive and deception and so forth, that's what governments do. I mean, if you subject the British and U.S. government statements to scrutiny, and we do this in our book extensively, we have had lie and deception and spin as an ongoing part of the U.S. foreign policy facade put forward to the American people. And so to say somehow that there's an extraordinary deception coming from the Iraqi government, I think is really to allow our window on the world to be painted red, white, and blue by the news media.
We're talking to Norman Solomon. The phone number here at Media Matters is 333-9455, toll-free 1-800-222-9455. We've got a couple callers. Let's go right back to the phone lines. Line 3, Urbana, you're on the air with Norman Solomon.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I'm not necessarily pro-war, but I have a question for the guest. Why should I take him seriously as an advocate of balance in the media when he is so obviously not balanced in his coverage and not balanced in his opinions?
Well, you know, what I think news media need to do is have a wide array of voices. And I think that if voices such as mine are included in the mix, then people really have some kind of ongoing debate to listen to and be part of, rather than the skewed debate that passes for wide-ranging coverage right now. I mean, if you take a look at our book, Target Iraq, I think you'll see that we document a lot of what we have to say, and then I hope you can make your own determination. I would add that we often talk about media bias issues in broadcasting and print and cable and so forth, but rarely talk about it in the book industry itself. And we discuss in our book the way in which other books have been promoted as some kind of objective look and actually then ricochet through the mass media, and there's kind of a tilt that is very pronounced in the book publishing industry as well to promote pro-war positions, and I think we need to recognize that as well.
Well, you haven't answered my question, and that is, why should I consider you an advocate of balance when you yourself are not balanced? It's not balance. It's not fair to say, well, it's too shifted to the other direction, and I like balance, so therefore I will take the other position purely as a way of balancing out. That is not balance, or that's hypocriticism. That's,
well, you know, if you want a cipher, I mean, you can find some ciphers who don't have a point of view, have not done the research, and reached conclusions. I'm sure some of those ciphers are out there. What I'm saying is that you need to find a range of views, a variety of sources, to protect yourself from taking anything on faith. The last thing I would do is urge anybody to do that with what I have to say. But what I am saying is we need to be our own media critics, we need to be skeptical, and we need to draw not just from mainstream media, but independent sources as well.
Well, then why don't you present any post-war opinions?
Pro-war, you mean, I
said. Positions? Because that's not my position. It's not my belief.
And you were not balanced.
What does that mean? You want somebody that doesn't have a point of view?
I would have much more respect for you if you had said, look, I happen to take this position in the war, and my group is a proponent of this position, and that's what we'll call ourselves. We'll call ourselves the anti-war position and proponent, or that label your book, We're Against the War, which is fine. That's a great position to take. But don't hide behind the fact that you were calling yourself balanced and objective. You're not. You're very unbalanced and very subjective.
You know,
what's
I think
wrong
what
with that? But label it so.
What you've done is you've knocked down a straw dog that you constructed. What we're doing is trying to widen the range of debate. Excuse me. What we're trying to do is widen the range of debate by putting out other perspectives and information that you may not hear otherwise.
Fine, but why don't you call yourself that?
Why don't you call us whatever you choose? The point is, you're knocking down an argument that was never presented to you in the first place.
Let me just interject if I can, caller Norman. I mean, Norman, if I understand, you aren't saying that you're presenting a neutral position that represents all viewpoints. And the viewpoint, your second part is the position you're advocating or arguing is not that you're assuming it just because it's opposite the dominant opinion, but you're arguing what you believe to be the truth. Is that a fair statement?
Well, I'm not writing front-page news articles, nor am I writing news articles at all. What I'm doing is saying we've analyzed the information. This is our conclusions. You should consider the evidence that we provide in our book and on the air and draw your own conclusions. See if ours make sense to you.
Yeah, but we should also take into account what you don't present in the book, too, don't you think?
Well, once you read the book, you can tell me what you think's wrong with it.
Yeah, but you haven't answered my question again. Why don't you present, you know, there are things in the book that you don't present. Is that true?
I'm not understanding your question.
Are there sides and opinions and facts and certain things you could find, but you do not present, for instance, anything that's pro-war?
Well, for instance, I'm glad you mentioned that because we have dozens and dozens of pages in the book devoted to the UN Security Council Resolution 1441, which we don't agree with, but we put it in the book and then critique it. We also print in its entirety George Bush's most important pro-war speech on October 7th of last year, just before Congress voted. So we let him have his say in the book, and we critique it.
You critique it, but do you do any writing in praise of it or constructive thing? This is right, he's right in this point.
Well, do you want, again, somebody who doesn't have a point of view? Then I think that you're barking up the wrong tree here.
No, I want a balanced approach, which is what you propose.
See, what I'm pushing for...
Which is not what you're providing. I'm beating a dead horse, or I understand.
Yeah, I think you are, but what my point is that in the totality of media coverage and commentary, we want to hear all sorts of different voices. My voice will not provide all those different voices, but in the absence of strong anti-war analysis, we're going to be lacking the kind of discourse that we need for true democratic decision-making in our society.
Thank you for taking my call.
Certainly. We've got a bunch of other callers who have been waiting very patiently. Line 4, Clifton, you're on the air with Norman Solomon.
Yes, Mr. Solomon. I am a World War II veteran, and I don't know if we ever learn about appeasement or not, but we tried to appease Hitler with some of Dodler and Patton's saying, well, here, we'll let you have this. And I don't like the fact that I had 292,131 of my buddies killed in World War II, and I don't want my grandkids, my granddaughters and grandsons to go and get in a war. But appeasement has never seemed to work, and so I say, we can sit around on our haunches and wait till Saddam does something. But I think we have no choice. We've got to go and get him and take him out of there. And I don't want to take off the over the autonomy of another country. And that's the reason that we didn't get him before when George Bush Sr. was president. We wanted to see if they couldn't straighten their own mess up. And obviously they can't. And so I'm a little bit disturbed too by you saying that we're a bunch of killers. They killed 53,400,000 people in World War II. Is that what you want?
Well,
I'll stop there and let you see what your comments are.
Okay, thanks. I'm not sure who the they are. It was a lot of different theys that killed so many people. But I think the argument, which has gotten wide currency in the news media now, also got wide coverage during the Vietnam War. It's a boilerplate one about appeasement. You know, we heard, and I remember this personally, during the build-up to the Vietnam War, we heard about Munich, we heard about the man with the umbrella, and how appeasement never pays. You can't just, I believe, take a standard boilerplate argument and overlay it to every situation. In retrospect, those who were taken in by the argument that we can't have appeasement, so we've got to be having a war in Vietnam, they were fooled. They were bamboozled into a bloody war that went on for pretty much a dozen years or so in terms of U.S. involvement. Ron Kovic is a Vietnam veteran we quote extensively in our own book. He's seen war firsthand. He suffered from it. He's been directly involved in it. He wrote the autobiography, Born on the 4th of July. I wish he was seen more in news media. He occasionally is on television. But, you know, these analogies, and this would be my last point in response, these analogies really fall down when you look at the actual situation with Iraq. For more than 12 years, they have not invaded any country whatsoever. To compare that very contained regime to the Third Reich, I think, is an absolute misreading of history.
Now, I mean, to add on to that, Nazi Germany was the second most powerful economic nation in the world after the United States, and by far the dominant economic power of Europe in the late 1930s, whereas Iraq isn't. The other point, that it seems, if Iraq is such a threat, an expansionist threat, one would think that the people in the immediate region, who would be the ones who would be taken over by Saddam Hussein, would be the ones who would be leading the fight against him. Would that be logical?
Yeah, I think it's a key point. And obviously, most countries in the region, the last thing they want is a war, and they're being dragged, kicking, and screaming by the U.S. to accommodate the Pentagon's plans.
We've got two more callers I'm going to get to in a second. Let me first say that you're listening to Media Matters on WILL AM 580. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. We welcome your calls. Our guest today, Norman Solomon, the Executive Director of Institute for Public Accuracy, and the co-author with Reese Ehrlich of a brand new book, literally hot off the press, Target Iraq, What the News Media Didn't Tell You, with an introduction by Howard Zinn and an afterword by the actor Sean Penn. I should mention that if you're interested in getting weekly updates on our show, Media Matters, who our guests will be, all you need to do is go to my website, which is simply robertmcchesney.com, and you'll see a link right on the homepage. You can get a weekly email update on who our guests are going to be and links to their work. Coming up next week, we're going to have Michael Copps, a member of the Federal Communications Commission, talking about the new plans by the Federal Communications Commission to consider a relaxation of media ownership in the United States. It's going on as we speak. The following week, we're going to have Eric Alterman, who was supposed to be on last week, you might remember, discussing his new book, What Liberal Media? Alterman will be back 2 weeks from today. And then 4 weeks today, from today, we're going to have a show on celebrities. Interestingly enough, since Sean Penn has been very active at opposing the war in Iraq, celebrities in politics, specifically celebrities in the war. And our guests are going to be a Hollywood producer, Robert Greenwald, and the actor Mike Farrell, best known probably for his performance in MASH over the years. So let's go back to the phone lines now. With our guest Norman Solomon. Line one, Urbana, you're on the air.
I'm Champagne.
Oh, Champagne. Okay, I apologize for that.
Okay, I have like two questions or one question, actually. I mean, two points. I don't see anything in the news media in the United States to talk about like the post-war Iraq, which is like people talk about like going in and killing and occupying, and they don't understand what occupying is. You know, what does it mean, you know? And they don't look at the example of the Israelis. They went into West Bank and Gaza and against people who have nothing, just stones and just like what, some handguns and some minor Kalashnikov here and there. And they have like homemade bombs. And look what's happening to the Israeli army. I mean, like they're still fighting and the Israeli economy is just down to nothing almost. And other than the $12 billion we give them, they come here to ask for. And what do you think is going to happen to the American soldiers? Even if they conquer Iraq and even if the Iraqi army is with the American soldiers, don't you think that Arab pride and Arab dignity, though, is going to have some resistance? And these people in Iraq, I mean, the Iraqi people are armed. I mean, you know, people are going to be armed with like, machine guns. They're going to have bombs and, you know, more weaponry than the Palestinians did. And the second point I want to make is, they talk about the United Nations resolutions and all this, that this guy, like Iraq, did not comply with. Well, Israel never complied with any for the last 50 years. With any United Nations. Actually, last year when they massacred people in Jenin, Palestinians, women and children being Christians and Muslim Palestinians, they massacred and they destroyed Palestinian churches and mosques. The United Nations introduced a resolution which everybody voted on, and Israel told them to go jump in the lake. And the United States said, oh, okay, that's all right, we won't do that now. So, I mean, I just want to have your...
Yeah, I think one of the failures of U.S. media coverage of this whole crisis has been to not have a context for the violations of UN Security Council resolutions. There have been 16 or 17 resolutions violated by Iraq. But there are more than 100 UN Security Council resolutions that have been violated by various countries, including well over a dozen by Turkey, by Israel, by Morocco, also by Indonesia. And so how is it that the United States takes upon itself the power and right and prerogative to enforce with military attack those particular resolutions violated by Iraq? What about other countries? Would they have the right then to bomb their country of choice, to bomb Israel or Morocco or Turkey because of other resolutions which also are still being violated after many, many years of violation? It's just a fact that in Orwellian fashion drops from the U.S. media radar screen because it's not one that the U.S. foreign policy establishment wishes to have talked about.
So if I follow your logic, Dorman, it means that the United States could pick any of a number of other countries that it could declare susceptible to an invasion. By the same logic, it declares it okay to invade Iraq. There's no reason just Iraq would be singled out. And secondly, there's no reason the United States alone should be able to play this role. If Uruguay decided to invade Turkey based on this, it certainly has as much rationale as the U.S.-led invasion of Iraq. Is that correct?
Oh, absolutely. And underlying this blatant hypocrisy, which gets little note in our own media in this country, is just the operational precept in Washington that might makes right, and yet it's dressed up, gussied up in all this very fancy, high-flown rhetoric. The other point from the caller about the post-war situation in Iraq,
mm-hmm.
it reminds me a bit of the CEOs who just think of the next few quarters, if that. You know, what's the balance sheet going to look like when we post our next earnings, and how will the stock price do in the short term? It's not particularly a concern, and I think that's the case because my assessment is that policymakers in Washington and all too many journalists who internalize their priorities, they don't really, when push comes to shove, have such great concern about the human consequences. They're moving the chessboard around for their own careers and the geopolitical positioning and strategies in that region of the world. And so just as now in Afghanistan, remember all the high-blown concern a year ago in the media and out of the White House, what was going to happen in Afghanistan? That country is still in a disastrous state right now. You have the president of Kabul there, Karzai, not of the country. And the warlordism is as bad as ever, and very little concern about the well-being of Afghan people in the U.S. media.
Let's go back to the phone lines. Line 2, Urbana, you're on the air with Norman Solomon.
Yeah, I had several comments. One was that I think an earlier caller was saying, well, we shouldn't appease warmongers. And the thing is, I've heard so many arguments that say, well, you know, the war is like, you know, World War II was like Vietnam. You know, what we need to not appease is unilateral warmongers. Those are the people who need to be not appeased. Adolf Hitler was a unilateral warmonger who was attacking foreign countries, attacking other sovereign countries. It was a critical that we not appease Hitler. And 10 years ago, or 12 years ago in 1991, Saddam Hussein was a unilateral warmonger attacking a foreign country, which was Kuwait. And it was important, and George Bush Sr. did that. We did not appease Saddam, and we pushed him back into Iraq. But what we have to ask today is, who is the unilateral warmonger now? Is it Saddam Hussein, or is it someone else? Whoever is a unilateral warmonger, that is who needs to be not appeased.
Okay. Norman, do you want to make a comment?
Well, I mean, I really think the evidence is there that it's the United States that has taken it upon itself the unilateral right to attack a country that's not attacked any other regime. And when we hear in 12 years and has no objective power or inclination to do that, the argument it's about human rights is preposterous. I mean, the torture going on in Egypt right now is horrendous, and the U.S. government, far from getting ready to lob missiles on Cairo, is sending billions of dollars a year there. So it gives the lie to this argument. I think quite often of a statement made by A.J. Mustey, the great anti-war leader at mid-century in this country, mid-last century, who said that after a war, the problem is with the victor, who has concluded that it is massive violence that is a solution to problems. Who will disabuse that victor of that conclusion. That victor in the recent years especially has been the United States government, and the conclusion of policymakers in Washington, all too often echoed by the U.S. punditocracy, is, yes, might makes right, and as long as we can win, quote-unquote, the war was a good thing.
Especially if the war involves casualties of non-Americans almost exclusively.
Yeah.
Let's go back to the phone lines. Line 3, Champaign, you're on the air with Norman Solomon.
Yes, I think it's indicative of the mood of the country that while we're talking about media matters, and all of us are impassioned to express our views specifically on this particular international crisis. But the question or the comment that I wanted to make before I listened for the last half hour from earlier comments is, if you take a look at the front page of the New York Times today, it says very much about the media. The fact that there were any protests in New York itself is buried in the small print of the second paragraph.
You know, caller, I should interrupt because I noticed that too, and I called a good friend of mine who lives in New York City because we get the national edition of the New York Times.
Mm-hmm.
And he said that the local edition actually had very extensive coverage, so it might have been a deadline matter for that. I just want to add that as a proviso.
Yeah, well, it would be nice if the national edition could have had some of that too. But, well, appreciate the show. Thank you.
Well, thank you for calling. Okay, let's go back to the phone lines. Line 1, Urbana, you're on the air with Norman Solomon.
Yes, hello. Thank you for taking my call. I'm trying to imagine what the Bush administration's strategy might be now that things have changed in the past couple of days kind of dramatically with what's happened with all of the worldwide demonstrations and what happened with the Blix report and this kind of thing. And what would they be now planning to do as forces seem to be changing? And the thing that makes me the most worried, because I totally distrust them, and you see how much a public alarm works in the warmongers' favor, I'm just really nervous that since recently we've seen suddenly the Bin Laden tapes appear, and we go to Code Orange alert, you know, just when they kind of need to trump up some public support for their position, hasn't worked. But I'm wondering if, and very nervous at the thought that maybe what we're going to see is some, like, now tragedy, and that's, you know, maybe going to work in their favor, and maybe will have been something trumped up. I hate to think of it that way. I hate to be so such a conspiracy thinker, but I'm wondering if you have any comment on that, if we may not see some real tragedy suddenly occur that's going to work to get everybody nervous and line up for the war.
Yeah, the Bush team's strategy is clearly at this time tangled up in some of its own contradictions to claim to be multilateral and find itself so isolated to claim to want to respect the UN while left the choice of doing so and not getting what it wants, or simply thumbing its nose to do what it wants, which is to launch this massive attack. I really feel that given how big the world is, how much violence there is in a lot of different directions, the U.S. government doesn't have to trump up anything. It can simply do an enormous amount of spin, like this code escalation to high terrorism warning, to exploit tragedies as they do occur. And that's really the way that they function. And a lot of it's the double standard around when violence is visited on others designated as U.S. enemies, well, that's justice. And when we incur violence, that is something that requires massive retaliation.
Norman, we're almost out of time. I've got two callers I want to get to, but I do want you to address one point specifically, which deals with this issue of the link between Iraq and al-Qaeda and terrorism, because it seems like the momentum against terrorism in this country, which was intense following 9/11, has been sort of converted into anger against Saddam Hussein. And is that legitimate? I mean, what is Saddam Hussein's relationship with the terrorists who blew up the World Trade Center?
The relationship is basically zero. We have a chapter in the book called Spinning 9/11, and it really talks about the way in which as Twain once said, you know, a lie can get halfway around the world before the truth even gets its boots on. All the purported links that were pushed through the news media by the Bush administration between Saddam Hussein and al-Qaeda have evaporated, and yet the polls show upwards of half, between half and two-thirds of the U.S. public, depending on the poll, believe that there was some involvement. And this is, you know, the efficacy of propaganda in the face of lack of evidence that is really quite stunning.
Well, let's get back to the phone lines. Line two, Champagne, you're on the air with Norman Solomon.
Hi, Norman.
Hi.
You know, one of the arguments that's been made, the difference between the, you know, those other 100 people or countries that have not fulfilled UN sanctions in Iraq is that we have such a vested interest, since we were the one that brokered that, you know, when we won the war in 92, we're the ones that brokered this UN thing. I think there was a lot of argument at that time for us to go in and finish off Saddam at that time, and of course the coalition was against that, so we allowed, okay, we'll allow that as long as Iraq disarms, and now they aren't showing any proof of disarmament, and that's why we'd have a vested interest in Iraq right now where we may not have with the other countries. And I was wondering what your opinion on that take was.
Yeah, well, it's actually 100 or so resolutions that have been violated by a number of different countries. And sure, the victors designed and defined the terms after the war. But these are all important issues, and important issues and possibilities of people to take seriously in human terms. I mean, the occupation of the West Bank, the Moroccan role in North Africa, Turkey's role in Cyprus, Indonesia's human rights abuses, these are all crucial issues. And to say, well, some of them matter and some of them don't, is really a prerogative of a superpower saying some lives matter and some don't.
Norman, do you think that Iraq is a greater threat to the United States or other countries today than it was 3 years ago or 5 years ago? I mean, is there a reason why this is the exact moment that Iraq needs to be confronted?
Well, the reason seems to be U.S. domestic politics, both 9/11 opening the door for what a lot of people like Rumsfeld and Cheney have wanted to do for a long time, and also some might theorize the economy is going through the floor in the U.S. This is a good distraction. It clearly helped Bush last year to cut against a focus on the economy in the closing months of the election campaign. And ultimately, if you look at North Korea and look at Iraq is a debilitated military regime under civilian clothing, but the military is very weak. And that's the objective facts, but that doesn't seem to cut much ice either in the White House or in the U.S. news media.
So by principle, North Korea should be a much greater threat than Iraq if we're actually concerned about weapons of mass destruction.
Oh, without a doubt.
Let's go back to the phone lines. Our last caller, line three, Urbana. We've only got a few seconds left, but please get your question in.
Hi. I'd like to know your thoughts on several weeks ago when the United States intercepted a ship with a cargo of Scud missiles that the U.S. thought was going to Iraq and turned out it was going to Yemen. Why, if the United States was really interested in preventing terrorism, it allowed the ship to go on to Yemen and not to all friendly nations?
Well, I don't know the answer to that question. We deal with questions of military aid on the Institute for Public Accuracy website, which is accuracy.org, and I hope you can pay a visit there.
Thank you.
Okay, Norman, we've only got a little bit of time left, so I just want to let you just give any closing comments, if you would. What do you expect in San Francisco this afternoon?
Well, I think well over 100,000 people will be demonstrating in the next 2 or 3 hours, and it really is part of this upsurge going on. I know that following up on it, you're going to have student strikes in early March in this country, and it's really, I think, a clash between the power brokers in Washington and all they represent, and really grassroots revulsion in this country and elsewhere against this, what appears to be a horrendous war on the near horizon.
Our guest today has been Norman Solomon, the executive director of the Institute for Public Accuracy and the co-author of the new book, Target Iraq. Norman, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Bob.
It's been a pleasure, and we'll have you back in soon. You're sort of our beat reporter now on the war in Iraq. And my name's Bob McChesney. I'll be back with you next week with our guest, Michael Copps of the FCC. And please join us then. I want to thank Ben Scott, our wonderful producer, and see you in 167 hours.